Welcome to the Onyx Pathcast. I'm today's host, Eddie Webb, and with me I have Matthew Dawkins.
Hello there.
And Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
And today we're going to be interviewing Megan Fitzgerald, one of our freelance developers here at Onyx Path, as part of our second episode, trying new formats, see how things go. And Megan's really just a fascinating woman and very, very hard worker. I mean, she's worked on a ton of stuff. I know she's was one of the co-developers for changing the Lost Second Edition. She's been working on a couple of our Exalted products. I know she was a writer for you, Matthew, on the Contagion Chronicle. She did some writing on Scion. She's just, I think she's working on every game we have at this point.
I've also hired her. I also hired her on V20 Dark Ages Companion. I think that was the first book that I hired Megan for. And to be honest, I was incredibly impressed back then. She is one of my favorites of our stable of freelancers. So yeah, I'm very much looking forward to listening to this interview once it's done, because sadly, I will not be present for its recording.
Oh, no.
No, indeed.
No.
Yes. Due to my location in the world, I am restricted and honored to interview the Hungarians, Estonians, and Finns in our freelancer stable. And you two get to interview all the Canadians, Mexicans, and Americans that we happen to hire.
It's a good division of labor.
Yeah.
I guess it's unless we can find that rare creature, the game developer who wants to get up before noon. Or gets out of work before then.
Or lives in Bermuda. Because, you know, that nice, nicely straddles the Atlantic divide.
Hey, we'll just move the whole podcast to Bermuda. There we go.
But before you do this interview, as I will not be present for it, I do have one critical question that you're going to need to ask Megan in my absence.
Okay.
So, taking inspiration from a popular British podcaster by the name of Richard Herring, he's a comedian in these parts. He interviews such folk as Stephen Fry, Armando Iannucci, other comedians, and occasionally his interviews just stop. He feels awkward. He doesn't know what to do, and so he throws in an emergency question, which is the questioning equivalent of having a mild fit on stage and just throwing out whatever's on your head. So I will prepare you with an emergency question inspired by Richard Herring's. And the emergency question for Megan is, if you were dying in the desert, which celebrity would you like to come over to you and stroke your hair as you gently expire? Well, give us an insight into her psyche. And with that, I will take my leave.
I think we have to, is that your psyche too at this point? but yeah, hopefully we won't need the emergency question. I'm sure that there won't be any awkwardness at all in this interview. With that, let's go see if we can schedule that and set it up.
Okay, have fun.
Sounds good.
Hi, I'm Eddie, and I'm here with Dixie.
Hello.
And our guest today is Megan Fitzgerald. She is the developer for Changeling Second Edition, and she's working on the Contagion Chronicle and just a gazillion other things. So, hi, Megan.
Hi.
So, as the first interview, so very much appreciate you coming on to our show and helping us out with it.
Sure, thank you for inviting me.
No problem. Matthew couldn't make it, so he did ask us to pass along a question. If you were stranded in the desert, close to death, which celebrity would you want to stroke your hair?
Oh my goodness. The first one that comes to mind is Tom Hiddleston.
Ooh, very good choice.
Solid choice.
He probably a very good petter, I would think. and right to awkward. There we go. Excellent.
Yeah, let's
great way to start this off.
Get straight to the curveball question, Eddie. That's very well done. Like, we have all these questions where we're like, you know, what are you working on? No. How do you feel about Tom Hiddleston?
In my defense, this was the question that Matthew asked me to ask. It's not my question. But
which,
also,
of course,
he
could get away with because he's not here.
Right, exactly. See, so you know, also, we can throw him under the bus, and he absolutely won't listen to this.
I think he can get away with that stuff too because of the accent. Like, I feel like he can just get away with asking much more awkward things.
Well, we're Americans, so we're predisposed to listen to British accents, I think.
It's true. It's weird.
So, but actually, in all seriousness, though, Megan, you are working on a ton of stuff. I mean, you know, what's the short list right now of what you're working on?
Let's see. Okay. Let's see. So we've got the Changeling Kickstarter, all the stuff that came out of the Kickstarter, stretch goals and backer rewards and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Dark Eras 2 is entering first drafts where the writers are getting started, so we're dealing with that. Hunter Devil's Night Parade and Adversaries of the Righteous, the two EX3 monthly release books, those are going on right now. So we're in the middle of Contagion Chronicle. I think it's in red lines right now, so... that's happening too. We'll be doing final drafts at some point. What else? And I just finished, not Onyx Path related, but I just recently handed in my final draft for the Modern Age Companion for Green Ronin.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. I didn't know you were working on that.
Yeah, yeah. Malcolm Shepard is the developer. It's really a lot of fun. I love the age system. Modern Age is going to be just awesome.
And I'm curious, I mean, feel free to kind of completely dodge this question if it's awkward, but what is the comparison working with, like, you know, is there a lot of difference between working with Onyx Path and Green Marine? Is it fairly similar? Is there a lot of difference, nuance?
There's not a lot of difference working. I haven't noticed a lot of difference working with Onyx Path or working with Green Marine. It's been pretty much the same process. Trying to think of other companies that I work with. Mostly have been pretty similar, I think.
I noticed that too. I mean, I've had some people who will... there's some companies that have their own little quirks. Like, I know when I worked with Margaret Weiss Productions on Firefly, they had some approvals they had to go through. But I think that was partially because we had to go through Fox television approvals.
Yeah.
And there's some weird... things with that. So I think it's more project specific, but I'm always just curious, like, what it's like to work with other companies and what you can learn and pick up from them.
It is a similar thing. Actually, I worked on the Star Trek Adventures Science Division supplement for Modiphius, and that was a similar thing where there were certain things we had to do just because of the license, and the company had to go, you know, they had their particular things that they needed, say, like formatting things or whatever, ways to refer to things in the Star Trek universe that the licensor said we had to do. So that was interesting.
Yeah, I've had similar experiences. I worked on a Star Wars supplement for Fantasy Flight, and it was the same thing. Like, there is a very specific in-universe Bible. Megan, how was working on Star Trek? Because I know how much you absolutely hate that property. It's your least favorite property of all time, am I correct?
No, it was completely awesome. I've been a huge Star Trek nerd since I was a kid, so it was really, really cool to get the offer to work on that. And I don't want to say too much because I don't know how much I can safely say, but for people who know me, they will not be surprised to hear the part of that book that I worked on. I'm just going to say that.
Last time that I went to a convention where Megan and I were both attendees was PAX Unplugged last year, and I think the only thing I saw her buy was two ridiculously giant boxes of some kind of Star Trek.
They were having a big, like, final day sale on all the Star Trek Ascendancy board game stuff, so I bought the entire board game and every supplement.
That's amazing. I mean, it's always kind of surreal to work on a project that you're also a fan of, right? I mean, it's always like, it kind of like, you know, you have those moments of like, am I really doing this? Like, I know when my first started working on Vampire the Masquerade with Justin on 20th Anniversary Edition, it's like I had worked with Justin in the office for several years by that point in time, but there's still those occasional moments where it's like, I'm working on Vampire with Justin Achille. It's like, holy crap, you know? It's pretty bizarre.
Yeah, like, I never worked on that stuff, but I definitely had that moment when I got the Changeling 20 manuscript. And I was just like, 15-year-old me would not believe this is happening.
Yeah.
So, I'm actually curious, Megan, how did you get into even playing or interacting with role-playing games?
Let's see. When I was a kid, I used to play, like, those dungeon crawling board games, which is kind of like a gateway drug to role-playing games. But
Oh, like HeroQuest?
Yeah, yeah. And then the first time I actually ever played a tabletop RPG was I was freshman year of high school. I had been reading every Dragonlance novel that I could get my hands on, and I met some friends who loved Dragonlance, and they were like, hey, you know, we play D&D, do you want to come play with us? And I was like, hell yeah, I want to come play with you. So yeah, so my very first ever RPG was D&D 2nd Edition. I think my first character was a half-elven ranger, because at the time I was 13, and I thought that Tanis half-elven was the bomb. So that was that.
I think a lot of people's first characters were half-elf rangers. I'm pretty sure mine was.
Is that a template? Just here's your half-elf ranger. Welcome to D&D.
Well, because they're really pretty. They're still a little human. They're graceful. You know, they're interesting to play. And rangers are good all-around characters. I will still in a new game just throw together a ranger like first thing. Just to be like, I can do so many things. I can track things, and I can make sure we have food, and I can also, you know, shoot arrows. And it's great.
My default D&D character became the bard, though. As soon as I discovered bards, that was it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? What about the bard draws you to them? I'm curious.
I've been a musician all my life. I was a music major in college, and I like the jack-of-all-trades thing and being able to do a little bit of everything, but I also just love the idea that magical music is a thing that you can do.
Oh yeah, totally. I can totally see that. I mean, it's the idea of spells aren't just this weird arcane cryptic thing, but there's an artistry to them. I could see why that'd be really, really attractive. Has music played a lot of a role in your writing and development?
Not really. I don't know, it's sometimes, like, if I try to say, I don't know, like, write up an NPC who's a musician or something, I end up feeling like a total goober, and I don't like it. Just, it's like I'm too much, like, I don't know, like, too much injecting something from my real life into, I don't know, it feels goobery, and I don't like doing it.
That's totally fair. I mean, I know some of the writers I've worked with, they're very much, they like to inject bits of their life into their work, but also sometimes it gets, I mean, if it's something like that, it's like you say, you know, I don't want to overload people with my amazing thoughts and knowledge of it, and other times it just gets a little too personal.
It feels too real, it's like I'm putting too many real details in there that aren't necessary.
Right, yeah, and you kind of go, am I the one who's interested in this? Am I the only person who cares about this?
Yeah.
I can totally see that. So how did you actually get started working on role-playing games?
Actually, I submitted to the Onyx Path Open Call. I want to say it was maybe like late 2013 or something like that. And my first project was it was the Promethean 2nd Edition and the Firestorm Anthology.
Oh, very cool. I was just talking about Promethean.
Was that 5 years ago?
Something like that. Close.
It all blurs together after a while, I swear.
Yeah.
He's bad as Rich. That would have been under Matt McFarland. And did you learn a ton about developing from him, or is it more just kind of over various projects?
I learned a lot about development just from observing Matt, because I worked on a ton of projects with Matt, but also kind of every developer I've worked for, I pick up bits and pieces of their process, you know, kind of, I don't know, an amalgamation of observation of all the different developers I've worked for. I steal things here and there. So like, oh, I really liked the way that developer did that. I'm going to do that. Matthew has this policy that if you write a paragraph and it doesn't contain at least one story hook, why'd you write that paragraph? And I really liked that when I wrote for him on the V20 Dark Ages companion, and that was the first thing I worked for him on, and he said that, and I said, you know, I really like that policy, I'm going to steal that.
Absolutely. And so, I mean, so has a lot of your current development style just kind of an amalgamation, or have you found some interesting tricks or your own ideas and thoughts on as a developer?
I probably a little bit of both, I would say. Kind of an amalgamation plus just little things that I've learned over time. doing this. Not that I've done it for that long, but trying to think of anything that's specific. Well, you know, one thing that Rose Bailey said to me has stuck with me ever since I started co-developing with her on Changeling. She said, if there's something that isn't the way you want it, don't be afraid to change it. You know, because I always kind of want, like, I want all of the individual writers' voices to come out, and I want to make sure that all of their awesome creative ideas come through. But just kind of, she was the one who said, you know, if there's something that isn't the way you want it, it's okay for you to make it the way you want it because you're the developer. So that stuck with me.
No, that's not true. I mean, because developer is a really kind of a strange position in the sense that you're not quite trying to get – you don't want to necessarily showcase all the writers' diverse voices completely because you want the combined product to have a unified feel. But at the same time, if you know are bringing a lot of different people onto a project, you don't want to completely lose that energy, that opinion, or that voice, that flavor that they all individually bring to a project. So there's always kind of this weird synthesis of, okay, that's a really cool bit, so I want to focus on that, but that has to line up with this other bit that another writer wrote. And so it's always kind of an interesting jigsaw puzzle, and that's one thing that I know Rose and I have talked about before, and it's really cool that she talked to you about that, the idea of sometimes you have to kind of just go with your gut and say, no, I really need to go this way.
Yeah,
I would say that as an editor, I really appreciate when developers do that, simply because it's great for everybody to have their own voices, but when I'm editing a book together, I want it to read like it was written by one person. And I think a lot of folks don't realize that there's books where we have a different person on each chapter, and then there's books when four people might write different sections of one chapter, and I don't want it to be jarring when someone gets from one section to another. I actually kind of weirdly apply, like, our company motto is, you know, many worlds, one path, and I kind of apply that to each individual book when I'm trying to pull the writers together and try to pull the voice together. It's kind of like lots of different people, but we're all on the same page. Which was a terrible pun after I said it, but whatever.
Many worlds, one page.
Yeah, but I mean, really, like, that's a super important thing, and especially, like, as a developer, like, it's your creative project, so, you know, you don't want to put out anything that isn't the way you think it should be. I think that both your and Rose's voices came through very, very strongly on Changeling TV. I'm super excited to hold it in my hands.
Cool.
Probably not as excited as you.
I am really excited to hold it in my hands.
And actually, that's an interesting kind of segue a little bit is, I know Rose was initially a very strong design factor in going to second edition, but how much did you kind of bring to it? Because it was a very well-respected project, and there were a number of people who really enjoyed the first edition. So there's always kind of a tricky balance if you don't want to change too much of what people love, but you also have to modernize it and make sure that it's going in a stronger direction. Did you find there's a lot of those choices you were making during the course of it? Did you feel that you just felt the setting was gelling in a good direction, you didn't have to mess with it too much? How did that kind of lay out for you?
Yeah, you know, one thing that was really great about working with Rose was that she trusted my judgment, you know? So it was really a very collaborative project, and she sort of got the ball rolling with the initial creative vision was mostly hers, but we wrote the writer's guide together, and we really talked a lot about all of the different things we wanted to do, the changes we wanted to make, and the things we wanted to keep. Especially on the systems, there was a lot that I mostly developed the systems chapters, and there was a lot in the systems that we did change because second edition is really a new beast, and a lot of things, you know, that we wanted. First edition Changeling had a lot of stuff that was sort of, it was very narrative, which we loved. But for the second edition Chronicles of Darkness system is a little bit more toolboxy, and I like to have a little bit more structure to my mechanics, just so that I, as a storyteller, understand how to run it, stuff like that. So, for instance, the Oniromancy and the hedge spinning systems are a little bit crunchier, just 'cause that's my preference. But yeah, I mean, most of the setting stuff is the same. We kind of shifted the, not shifted, but we focused on a few particular things that we really wanted to bring out, like the reciprocity of the weird, like what the weird actually is. And actually one of the things, there's a big focus on kind of goblin debt and becoming a hedge denizen and making deals with goblins that we really brought out, which came out of something that a writer did. We wanted goblin contracts in particular to be something where the carrot matched the stick. Like we wanted to give enough incentive to right. do it that the double-edged yeah. sword wasn't such a sharp edge that you didn't want to do it. So that's kind of what we gave the writers. We said, do something like that. And Steffi Devon came back with this awesome goblin debt system that I loved so much that I said, look, I want to expand this beyond goblin contracts and actually make it like a big thing. So that was really fun.
Yeah, Steffi's great. Yeah. I love working with her. So, I mean, that's frankly just a ton of really awesome stuff that came in relatively early on because, I mean, like you said, you haven't been developing for very long, and that's some really fantastic kind of insight. I mean, I've seen so many developers, and I've frankly been guilty of it, where they're a little too reverential of core material. To have a developer go in and say, no, we're going to kind of take this, tear this apart and put it together in different forms so it runs even better and brings out what's even cooler about things and gives it some more structure and design is frankly really, really bold. And everything I've seen so far is people have been loving the direction of second edition. So I think you've definitely hit that very, very well. So kudos. I mean, it's frankly just a really good book. I remember when I had to read the manuscripts for an unrelated project, was just like, yeah, I remember this was just what it was like when I was reading the initial notes when we were bouncing around with Ethan, you know, back in first edition. So it's really, really, it was exciting to see you and Rose be able to kind of take that and give it some more meat and some more of a I don't want to say a direction because it was, I mean, it was always a very targeted game, but there's a thoroughness of thought that goes through this. Like, you know, let's take all the stuff to the natural conclusion, like I said, with the goblins and whatnot. That was kind of almost there in the first edition. Being able to get to see that and go, yes, take these pieces is frankly insightful. So that's really, I'm really interested to hear like stuff like that. I mean, is there other projects where you were had a similar feeling of, yes, let's put this together in this direction, or was that one just kind of a storm in a bottle moment?
I don't know. I feel like it was a little bit storm in a bottle. You know, all of the other stuff that I've been working on as a developer has been a lot of fun too. I had a little bit with Dark Eras when I was putting together my outlines for Dark Eras. I felt a little bit like that, where this was sort of a new foray into a crossover heavy project with a lot of really cool historical details in there, and just kind of that synthesis moment where you gather all your research together, you read through all of the game lines that are involved, and you kind of pick out like, where are the points of commonality that these games have that I can use as my seed for crossover in this historical era? And what, you know, what themes can I pick out that really kind of unify these game lines in this historical era together to make something that's dynamic and cool to play in as a setting? Kind of when I hit that moment in the outline, I went, yes, I know what I'm doing with this. That was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, that's always great when that happens. We have a question from one of the people in the forums about that, so let me kind of go into that real quick. They actually want to – Nicholas Maloney had asked, how will crossovers work in Dark Eras, and specifically if each era will have specific rules about how the powers will interact. And since you had mentioned before about your really dig mechanics, have you had any thoughts about how that would work, or is it more on a case-by-case basis?
It's been pretty case by case for Dark Eras. Some of the eras will have more mechanical interactions than others. I think a lot of them, like some of them may just be mostly setting, kind of here are the themes and here are the places where, how do these individual beings from the game lines find reasons to work together or stuff like that. I did go into a little bit more detail, I don't want to say too much, but a little bit more mechanical detail with the Wild West era, because it's Mage and Changeling.
Okay.
And those are two game lines which both have kind of expansive metaphysics that go off in their own directions. And so I wanted to make sure that that storytellers had at least a little bit of guidance on how to run that.
Sure, how do contracts interact with spheres and that kind of thing?
Yeah, mostly the hedge, really. Oh, okay. Mostly like, you know, what happens when a mage gets into the hedge? How does a changeling make a deal with something like an abyssal entity for contracts? Just things like that, where it's just a little bit of guidance so that storytellers know how to kind of bring those metaphysics together a little bit.
So yeah, so I am not a Western fan generally, and you just kind of made me one, because changeling and mage in the Wild West sounds amazing. I mean, granted, I have been lucky enough to read the outlines, which is cool, but like, I'm super, super excited for that, because I keep just picturing, like, fey and mage duels in the middle of, you know, a dusty street and getting very excited.
Awesome. Yay.
And I mean, you know, Megan, so I tell a story. When Megan and I met in person for the first time, it was actually on the plane to Gen Con.
Oh, really?
Last year. Yeah, I had met her in person. We knew who each other were. And I started, like, just talking about various things we both worked on, and I started talking about my favorite chapter in Dark Era's Companion, which is called The Year Without a Summer, I do believe is the title. And mm-hmm. It is this really amazing Promethean chapter with Mary Shelley, and I'm like raving about it, and I see Megan's face and she's kind of lit up, and I'm like, what's going on? And she's like, I wrote that. So like, I am super interested in that still, and where you came up with that idea while we're talking about cool ideas.
Oh, Year Without a Summer?
Yeah.
So let's see. That was one where it wasn't too long after we had done the Promethean second edition book, and Matt McFarland had asked me to work on Year Without a Summer, and a lot of that was just me going and reading all of the journals, because you can find, like, there's a, like, Polidori's actual journal that he wrote about those times, and the Shelleys, Mary and Percy Shelley, have, like, a joint journal that they kept about that time that they had, and so I just kind of, I read those, and the actual historical events are so filled with drama.
Oh, yeah.
That it was just a really rich source already for pulling out some horror and some tragedy. And I find out with Dark Era is that, fiction is, they say reality is stranger than fiction. It really, like, a lot of times when you look up weird historical details, you're like, this thing actually happened, and I couldn't have come up with something weirder than that.
It's always kind of great when you can blend those two. Particularly, you know, it's interesting to me that there's kind of the obvious connection of Mary Shelley and Promethean, you know, because she wrote the modern Promethean, but also it was a fascinating little bit of resonance for me when I was hearing the story, because since Mary Shelley is in a lot of ways the birth of science fiction, a birth of genre fiction as we understand it, and so a lot of the stuff that she was working on allowed us to do the things we're doing now, so that's really a fun moment of working on a couple different levels when you can do that kind of stuff. It's always great.
Yeah.
So another thing that I'm interested in personally is Matthew mentions on our previous episode that you worked on the splats for the Contagion Chronicle. And that mm-hmm. project is pretty different from other ones I've worked on at Omics Path. So maybe you can kind of walk us through kind of how he got you, because you did the splats before anybody else started writing. And so I'm curious kind of how that came about and where you came up with the ideas for things like the Cryptocracy and the Geryad and all that.
Sure. When Matthew and I first started talking about it, we knew that, you know, Matthew knew that he wanted the splats to be kind of a reaction to various outbreaks of the contagion. So we were discussing sort of what is our axis of differentiation that the splats revolve around. And to figure that out, I kind of went through, it was a combination of kind of finding fundamental points of commonality among all the different game lines, sort of organizations and splats and themes, to find sort of the core of each splat that would resonate with the most character types, but also figuring out how that intersected with the various kinds of contagion. And I realized in the process of doing that, that I wanted that axis of differentiation between the splats to be about what they thought the contagion was and how they were going to deal with it. Because I felt that that helped to emphasize that the contagion is not one thing, you know, and that the storyteller could really decide, you know, this outbreak is about this thing or that outbreak is about that thing. And I wanted to make sure that there was an emphasis on what this organization actually does, so that, you know, when a player reads it and says, yeah, I want to play a member of that splat, I understand what they actually do and those are the things I want to do. But yeah, it was also just a question of sort of how can I get the most mileage out of, the most flexibility and mileage out of what this splat is about, that I could say, you know, a member of any of the game line's protagonists could join this and would have reasons to do that. Yeah, it was a really interesting process.
So, were you thinking about it less of what the splats are and more kind of what you saw them doing in the game line? Or is it more of the every game has their ruler type and every game has their religious type? I mean, was it a little bit of both?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I kind of thought about it like a sort of a common denominator, like a couple of really core concepts that were universal enough that there was at least one setting aspect or splat or something that could latch onto that seed, to make sure that you know, if somebody played a beast or a changeling or a vampire or whatever they were playing, there was at least one already established character type somewhere in that game line that could hook onto the seed of the splat and go, yeah, I would participate in that. So like even something like Beast, where there isn't necessarily like a religion splat, but Beast has the Dark Mother, and there's kind of these overtones of belief and faith in the Dark Mother as a little bit of a goddess figure. So that kind of thing. So even though where, you know, with Vampire, it was obvious, we've got the Lankeet Sanctum, and they would obviously have reasons to join something that was religion-based or faith-based. But then for some of the splats, you know, I try to pull out like little bits of their themes or their setting or something, that would allow them to hook onto those seeds.
And I think, for the audience's perspective, I actually worked on the powers, or some of the powers sections for that book. And so it was, I know, extremely helpful for me, because one of the things I really liked about your splat write-ups is the fact that they include what we do as an organization. This is what we do, and this is how we do it. Which is something you don't see very often in those kinds of write-ups. And so when I'm thinking about what kinds of powers these characters have, it's like, it's really, really simple to kind of go, okay, you know, this is the Gritocracy. They manipulate people and they try to dominate their perspective of reality. So that leads me towards a not only gameplay vectors, but also what kinds of abilities and cool things you could pull out. Was that something you just felt was missing in these write-ups, or something that kind of came naturally out of writing, or something you've always wanted to kind of inject in that kind of player character grouping?
It was something it was something I've always wanted to see out of splats, but also it came out of Changeling. Cause one of the big things that Rose and I were talking about, we really wanted to emphasize, was if you're a member of a court, what do you actually do? Like, what does that actually mean for you day to day in the modern world? Because, you know, you can say, well, yeah, the Spring Court is about desire and it's about emotion and it's about denial and it's about living your life to the fullest. But what does that actually mean for you as a character day to day in your life? So we really wanted to ground those in in the day-to-day from the character's personal perspective. And that's something I really like about that. So I wanted to carry that over too.
Yeah, and that's always, I think, where sometimes the strength of working on different games comes from, is that you could take something that worked really well on one project or one game and go, how can we apply what we learned from this into another game and both end up benefiting from it. So I always personally enjoy seeing that kind of spreading of tech, as it were. It's like, this chunk works really well here, we're seeing some of that in the story path system, I think. I know Neil mentioned you did some really cool stuff on, I think it was Scion, and it was like, oh, okay, this is something that we can import to Trinity and something that, you can use in DR. That's great. We can kind of share that information.
Cool.
Thanks. Speaking of that, is there anything that's, speaking of kind of what picking up influences from other sources, is there anything that's not produced by Onyx Path that you're really excited about right now, whether it's a game or a book or something?
So I mentioned Modern Age. I'm actually really, really excited for Modern Age to come out so people can see it. I love the Age system. It's very elegant. It works really well. And I like Modern Age's interpretation of it in particular because it's classless. So I think it really encapsulates all of the different genres that it's going for really well. For Modern Age in particular, for those who are familiar with the Age system, my favorite thing about that system is the stunts. And for Modern Age, I wrote not all the stunts, but most of them. And it was a lot of fun. And I'm really excited for people to be able to use those.
Wow, that sounds really cool. And so Modern Age is just kind of the modern version of the Dragon Age system, right?
Yeah. It's like if you played Fantasy Age or Dragon Age or Blue Rose, it's the modern sort of real world equivalent of those.
Cool. Yeah. How does their stunting system work? I'm actually not familiar with Age, I confess.
So it's the basic mechanic is you have 3d6 plus an ability modifier, but one of the dice is the stunt die. Or like in Dragon Age, it's the dragon die, but they do the same thing. Basically, whenever you want to do something, you roll 3d6 of your ability modifier for whatever you're doing, and one of those dice is the stunt die. And so if you roll doubles on your roll, then the value on that die is how many stunt points you generate, and then you can spend those stunt points on cool maneuvers or little advantages or helping your teammates out, all kinds of weird little things. And they come in different flavors. There's action stunts, exploration stunts, and social stunts.
Oh, wow.
So for Dragon Age, for instance, like if you've played Mass Effect or Dragon Age, the flirt stunt is what you use whenever you roll doubles, you get stunt points, and you say something to an NPC and you want to flirt with them, use the flirt stunt. And that's like choosing the romance option in Dragon Age. For Modern Age, actually, we did a lot with stunts with like subsystems and stuff like that. So you know how like a lot of RPGs, for instance, grappling or automatic fire or something like that is a little subsystem, and we kind of folded all that into the stunts, which I think it worked really well.
Yeah, it sounds really, really cool. Speaking of actually really cool, in our last episodes, Dixie mentions that you work at NASA?
Yes, I do.
What do you do at NASA? I'm curious.
So I am a taxonomist at NASA. So I work in the Earth Science Division. And so there's across the various NASA web platforms, like the main NASA site, but there's also the Earth Observatory site, which is a lot of like Earth science specific cool stuff that NASA can see on the Earth from satellites. Here's satellite images and what we're actually looking at and different just cool like Earth science content that goes out to the public. And there's more. There's also a site called SVS, which is something Visual Studio. I don't remember what it stands for, but they do videos and like animations of satellite images where you can see like
I don't know, volcano eruptions over time or something like that. Of this content goes out to the public. And so what I do is I have creating taxonomies, ontologies, and a catalog for all of that stuff so that people inside the agency can search, you know, hey, how many times have we done an article on volcanoes and where is all that content? Oh, I can look it up and say, here's all the stuff we did on volcanoes, how to just find all that content and build the vocabularies we need to be able to find it. That's my job.
So is this more like metadata or is this more like an explicit kind of reference system you're building?
A little of both.
Okay. I'm just curious because I have a friend of mine who she actually used to be an editor at OmicsPath, Genevieve Paldeski, but she is in library sciences, and so occasionally she'll start talking to me about similar ideas of how to structure that, and she's occasionally we've chatted about like how would we apply that kind of not that explicit reference system, but general reference ideology better to apply to game books because game books are this kind of weird amalgamation of you know what Matthew would call wet writing, not dry writing, but also it's a reference book. It's a reference manual, and sometimes we're not great at designing reference manuals as designers, and so it's like how could we apply all this other kind of like he called lexicography of or just how do we approach this different kind of sciences to it to make these books more useful at the table. And have you found that useful at all in terms of like your own design, or is it just completely apples and oranges and there's no real overlap?
Yeah, you know, I have found it useful. Even just stuff like how do I structure this chapter? You know, where do I put this information so it's easiest to find? That's how my brain works because I've been doing this library science thing for, you know, for years. So my brain always goes to, okay, somebody needs information. I have to get them the information. What's the best way to get them the information? So yeah, I do find that useful.
Is there something that drives you nuts that other writers do that you wish they would know they would do better about that?
I was literally about to ask that. I was going to be like, so do the rest of us make you insane?
I don't know. I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
Okay.
You're just so nice, man.
It's just that we did make this podcast for nice. I'm sure that if I took 5 or 10 minutes to think about it, I'd be like, you know what? but I can't think of anything.
That guy drives me nuts. Yeah.
You know, I was looking at Pugmire, yeah, and it's just the worst structure.
Oh my god, no. That guy can't write to save his soul.
No. You have a soul, Eddie? Huh? No. Anyway.
And the cover took it.
No more metaphysics.
I don't know if you had another thought or follow-up to that, but... okay.
Yeah. No, I'm just bad at podcasting.
Yeah, that was awkward. Okay, so we'll just cut that part out. It's fine.
I mean, or we can leave it in and just be awkward. Like, are we trying to convince the public that as game designers, we're cool? Is that
well? I mean,
is that the aim of this?
There's actually that's weird, and also yeah, we're leaving this in now. But there's this kind of weird cachet that I've noticed that designers and particularly developers have, and maybe you guys have noticed this. But that when you go from I'm now in charge of a thing, people suddenly have I don't want to say more respect for you, but there's like, oh, now what you're saying resonates with me more, and now I'm more interested in hearing specifics of the things that you're talking about. Whereas when you were, quote unquote, just a writer or even just a fan, and I use those very very loosely, there's a different kind of approach to that. It seems like particularly when you come from, because we have the. Because OmicsPath is kind of the son or the offspring of White Wolf. And they had a certain cachet of coolness about them. So I think we've also kind of got a weird bit of that, too. So, kind of.
I like that you kind of say you're cool when you just use the word cachet twice in the past 2 minutes. That's good.
I am 19th century cool.
Megan, actually that's something interesting. So because I do know you from conventions and we have, you know, hung out at conventions, I know that when we first really introduced you at a convention as the Changeling person was Gen Con. And you just kind of, like, you were at the booth, and you were answering questions, and you were meeting a lot of fans, kind of. I think for one of the first times that you were really, like, out there as, like, a developer. Am I correct on that? Yeah. Because I noticed that from there to PAX Unplugged, which was about 2-3 months later, you seemed a lot more used to it. what was it like, kind of, meeting, you know, Changeling fans for the first time, or Exalted fans for the first time, and going like, oh yeah, I'm in charge of this.
It was interesting. Funnily enough, that was actually also the first time, PAX Unplugged was also the first time that I had run a convention game for strangers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it was an interesting, I think it helped a lot that I wrote that adventure myself. So, like, I sat down and said, okay, I'm going to be running this game for strangers. It's going to be the first time they're interacting with Changeling, which I've been working with for, you know, months and months, and I know really well, but they don't. So how do I present this in a way that they'll get the idea and that they'll like it? And the interesting thing about PAX was that we had a lot of people there who had not only never played Changeling before, who had never played a White Wolf game before, or had even never played a tabletop game before at all.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were a lot of people that were just there because of the PAX branding, but they weren't specifically tabletop
really?
Gamers.
Yeah.
What was that interaction like? I'm curious. Like, oh, how was that show?
It was really interesting. They were... Yeah, I was excited that they were excited. You know what I mean? That they were curious about what is this thing where you roll dice and this looks fun. I want to try it. I think that actually helped me feel comfortable that people were asking me to explain something to them or to teach them something new. That I guess that's the librarian in me too, where people ask me for information and I'm okay. Like, I want to give you information. I think it's a little bit of that, like the feeling comfortable with them because they're asking me questions that I can answer, you know?
Right. Yeah, I can see that. I definitely get more uncomfortable when they ask me a question.
Oh, yeah.
That I can't
well, when
answer.
Somebody asks me a question that I can't answer, I'm like, go ask that person over there. Because I don't know.
Not my problem anymore.
But yeah, no, PAX is interesting for that because there were. I think the reason that they put it in Philly, and I could be completely wrong on this, this is all my hypothesis, so don't come for me, PAX people. Is that, like, I think part of the reason they kind of did it in Philly is because they're trying to catch some of the overflow from PAX East, because PAX East is so big now, to the point where it sells out immediately. Like, it's ridiculous. And so they tried to move a lot of the board game folks over to PAX Unplugged, folks who might not want to dish out for the PAX East fees. But with them came all the tabletop companies, which I've heard that we just don't have much of a presence in general, like in the RPG industry at those kind
of
conventions.
No, we don't.
And that it might be worth, you know, having more of one in the future. Because, yeah, the amount of people, they knew board games, and they knew video games. But they were like, what are these books you're selling? Like, we are very, like, how do you play a game with books? And all of us who've been playing games, like, I've been playing RPG since 92. I'm like, how do you not play games with books? Like,
right, what are you weirdos? Like, you don't use, like, 500 pages of rules? You're nuts. But I did see a little bit of that because I did go to PAX East 4 years ago, 3-4 years ago, around there, and it's in Boston. And so it was right around one of the D&D anniversaries because they had a tent, like actually inside the convention, they had a tent there. And it was the Dragon Inn or something like that. And it was like the D&D
Was it the Red Dragon Inn? Because that's like
maybe it was. All I know is we saw this huge line, and my wife was there with me. We're like, "What is this line?" And they, "Oh, we're playing Dungeons and Dragons." It's like, "Oh, cool. We'll do that." So we got in the line, we paid to play the event, and we sat down. And there was like six tables, each like three or four people at each table, and there's like six DMs one at each table. And there was a lot of like, this is Dungeons and Dragons, and this is how you play. And my wife, that she's been playing longer than I have, and so she's like, I know how this works. And so I was just trying to be quiet because I was just fascinated. It's like, okay, I'm curious how someone tells me how to play a role-playing game. I'm just curious what language they use and whatnot. My wife was like, can we get to killing things already? This will just get in my way. And so we played for like an hour and a half, and like, okay, cool, we're done. It's like, that's it. So, I mean, it was very much, how do you take D&D and repackage it for an audience that only understands how board games work. So I saw a little bit of that, and at the time I was like, that's really weird. But now that you guys are talking about PAX Unplugged, it makes a lot more sense to me what happened there.
Yeah, the PAX branding has been very strongly video game related for a long mm-hmm. time. So I think that's just going to be their main target audience, and the main folks that come to their events are the video game crowd, which is great. Like, I mean, Meg and I are both huge video gamers. We've been texting each other about Mass Effect Andromeda for the past few weeks now because she finally started playing it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I heard the fixes have helped improve
but
that.
But yeah, like, it was good to begin with. I don't care what anybody says. So I'm going to get hate mail for that. But
fair enough.
I like Mass Effect a lot, and I really liked Andromeda, and Megan finally picked it up, and I started getting these texts like, this is so good! And I'm like, yeah, I know. I know, Megan.
Duh, obviously.
But,
So we're getting close to time. So, Megan, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for putting up with our awkwardness through all of this.
No, thank you, guys. This was really fun.
How can people find you online if they wanted to chat with you?
I am FitzMorigna on Twitter. That's probably the best way. Or on the Onyx Path forums, actually. I'm just Megan Fitzgerald on the Onyx Path forums.
Okay, awesome. Well, then, thank you so much for coming on, and I'm sure we'll chat with you again in the future.
All right, thanks.
See you soon.
So that was a little more awkward than I expected it to be, but we had a good time, I think. It was a great conversation.
Well, to be fair, you did unleash the emergency question within about the first 5 minutes. So that
I
was
panicked, I'm sorry.
That was supposed to be kept in reserve. You launched the nuke too early, Generalissimo. I think you should have given the enemy the chance to surrender before you obliterated her. But, you know, what's done is done. Now we just have to pick through the wreckage.
Are we thinking of our guests as our enemies? Is that what's going to be happening on the podcast?
That was the memo I wrote.
So it raises so many questions. One, who gave that memo? And two, who uses memos?
It's more like a virtual sticky on my surface.
Everyone is the enemy.
Anyone who has worked on one of my books should know this by now. But no, I very much enjoyed that. I was obviously the first listener to this interview who was not a participant. And I enjoyed that because, as I mentioned in the intro, I find Megan is a fascinating person. She's an excellent writer. She's a brilliant developer. And she's one of our best, without doubt. And so getting her insight into books like Changeling and Contagion is always interesting to me to hear. Hopefully it is for the viewer listener out there as well. Although I guess if we're putting these up on YouTube as well, some of you might be viewing a static image. Hello, if you are. But, you know, it was gratifying to me as well to hear her speak so highly of my outline process, if nothing else, about me. You know, it's always good to get a compliment without actually being in the room.
See, and if you think of them as your enemies, you're not going to get that, Matthew.
No, they compliment me a little like the Politburo, the Presidium complimented Joseph Stalin, I think.
Just abject terror whenever you walk into the room.
Exactly.
I think you might think you're more intimidating than you are.
And that's another name on the list.
Well, this goes back to our conversation about us trying to be cool and the fact that we're clearly not. So I think we add intimidating to that as well.
No, I know. I'm a big cuddly Englishman, obviously. You know, I wouldn't harm anyone at all. And the problem is when I start saying that, that's when I come across as terribly insincere. And people think, oh, God, he's horrible. So it's better to stick with the dictatorial developer guise, and then everyone can think, he's just putting on a front.
We love you, Matthew. It's fine.
Well, that's the important thing.
And by love, we mean fear. It's all very Machiavellian.
Yeah, yeah. So how did you two feel that went, other than awkward?
I always love talking to Megan. Like I said, she's one of the first people I met in person from Onyx Path. So, like, ever since I, you know, met her in the airport on the way to Gen Con, I was like, we just kind of clicked. We get along very, very well. So it was fun talking to her in this capacity, because even though we chat a lot, I don't really talk to her about kind of do a deep dive into her work or what she, like, what her process is or anything. I've never really picked her brain on that. So that was interesting.
That's one thing, actually. That's a good point, is we definitely want to try to make these closer to the conversations we have, like when we're together at conventions or when we're on these calls and whatnot. But we just weirdly don't have time to talk about, or to never come around talking about things like, you know, our work and, hey, you know, how do you do things versus how I do things, and that kind of process comparison and like, so it's always fascinating for me. I love talking to other talented people and finding out how they work and what they bring to the table and what inspires them. Because I always find I can learn something from that. I always draw little nuggets from people's thoughts or processes. So it's actually rare that we get a chance to have this kind of conversation. So it's great to be able to do that and talk a little bit about how she approaches things.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, if you're at a convention, whether it's Gen Con, PAX Unplugged, whatever, there's, you know, several thousand other people around you. And it's so rare that you do get to sit down with just one person and kind of go like, hey, what is your work like? How do you do things? But also, like I said before, Megan's day job is fascinating to me. She thinks it's really boring. She's like, I'm a librarian pretty much. I'm like, I think it's cool. You work at NASA. Like, that's interesting to me. So
one thing I've always found is that people who are passionate about something, to me, I think are somewhat inherently interesting. If yes. They're really excited and passionate about something, then that enthusiasm injects into subject matter and it ends up becoming interesting as a result, I find.
Yeah, very, very much. I have definitely talked to people who I thought their, you know, jobs or interests were stuff I was not interested in at all. And then the minute they start talking and their eyes light up, you're just like, oh. Okay.
Well, maybe that's the direction we can take with some of our future interviews as well. We can, well, depending on how much the interviewee, the guest, wants to expose of themselves, we can ask them a little more about their, I want to avoid saying about their personal life, but about their out of role playing interests, because we kind of tentatively did this with this interview. And I guess it's something we need to listen to you, the listeners, on how interested you are about that, because we are ultimately writers, developers, editors, artists, depending on who gets asked on the show at any given time. And clearly none of us see ourselves as celebrities, and it's very rare for anyone to really describe themselves as an interesting person. I think most people that do aren't. So if you, the listeners out there, want to know more about these people we're talking to, more than just the Onyx Path side of their lives, then by all means tell us, because it will give some guidance as to the sorts of questions you want us to ask. And providing they're within the realms of acceptability, we will do it. And of course, the guest will reserve the right to say, absolutely not, I'm not telling them at all about my childhood in X, where I went to this school. But, you know, all of us have fun school days stories, so maybe we'll do that. Actually,
yeah.
And this is a tangent for the Interview with Megan episode, but here's something I wanted to ask you both, actually, because I know you touched on this in the intro, Dixie, and I don't think I've ever asked you this, Eddie. It was where you first role played, because for a lot of people it was at school. Dixie was mentioning the goth kids.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so what about you, Eddie?
It was school for me, but my intro is a little odd in the sense that I bought the D&D red box that Frank Mentzer put together. So, I mean, that starts the avenue, but no one wanted to play it because it was right in the middle of the 80s, right during the Satanic Panic. So a lot of the parents were aware that Dungeons & Dragons was a thing that was bad. But they had no problems if we talked about comic books. So a lot of us end up playing Marvel Superheroes game. So we would end up during like lunch or during recess or occasionally during detention. We would get together and, we played, superheroes in exactly the way you think that teenage boys would play superhero characters.
So mine's actually not the high school thing I was mentioning. It's not the first time I encountered it. So full disclosure, my parents are both nerds. I was raised this way. When my parents split up, my mom ended up getting a roommate for a while named Kim, and Kim played D&D. So she knew I was into fantasy already. I was always reading Chronicles of Narnia, or there was a weird little kids book series from the late 80s called Secrets of the Unicorn Queen I was super into, which I mention only because I named my first D&D character after one of the characters in that book.
The Unicorn Queen.
Yeah, her name was Illyria. It was important to me at the time. So I ended up playing in my living room that I grew up in with Kim and my mother. It was the first time I ever played. I was 7 years old, so it was probably AD&D 2, somewhere around 92. That was my first experience. And I also ran a kids game for all the kids of all their friends. So I remember doing some kind of dungeon crawl type thing with that too when I was probably 7 or 8. And then I just didn't play for a while until I got back into it in high school. But I was like, I remember this when I saw the kids playing it then.
Oh, wow. I'm a pretty late bloomer compared to the two of you then, because I only got introduced to role playing when I was at college. And college in Britain is a different period than college or university in America. It is the age is 16, 17, maybe 18, and then you go on to university. Mm-hmm. And so I was a big fan of the Baldur's Gate and Icewind Dale games by Black Isle and BioWare. And I was just searching on the forums, online forums, the Black Isle forum, where I had a username by the name of Lord of Bones. I used to run role-playing games, basically choose your own adventure games, because I'd always played fighting fantasy games when I was growing up.
Right.
And I played them in the playground, but they weren't, I guess, tabletop role-playing as such. And so I really got into Baldur's Gate. That hooked me in, specifically building a party of NPCs with their own little stories. I thought, this is brilliant. And so I was looking at the forums
right.
while I was at in the college library, and all of a sudden a pudgy, sweaty hand enveloped mine as it was on the mouse, and a shaky, quavering voice whispered in my ear from behind me. Go to this website. And he guided the cursor, my hand on the mouse, his on mine, and guided the cursor to the search bar, and actually tried to direct me to a Spycraft website. And I said, I'm not really interested in Spycraft. And by this point, I realized it was one of the school librarians. Hello, John. And I won't give his surname, because he's actually a conservative counselor now, and describing him as, well, to be honest, politicians have got in trouble before for having a secret role-playing hobby on the side. So I said, I'm more interested in this Baldur's Gate thing. And he said, oh, yeah, that's Dungeons & Dragons. I said, is it? And he said, yeah, look, it says it right on the spine. So, yeah, that was a bit stupid of me. And a lot of things started clicking into place at that point. I realized that from about the early 90s, I had read this novel trilogy called the Moonshade Trilogy, which was set in the Forgotten Realms by Douglas Niles.
Yep.
And I'd read a lot of R.A. Salvatore's books as well, the Drizzt Do'Urden novels. And these had all been set in the Forgotten Realms, which, of course, was a Dungeons & Dragons campaign setting by Ed Greenwood. But I just never connected the fact that these novels that I had been reading for years were from a role-playing game world. And John said to me, I attend a club every Sunday. It's on the other side of the road to the Lunatic Asylum in Salisbury. It was on the other side of the road to the Lunatic Asylum in Salisbury. And
just go in this dark alley and nothing bad will happen to you.
The problem was, it was down a dark alley. And, now people can verify this tale because this home for the challenged and for people who needed a respite and the like was called the Old Manor. I believe it's shut down now. And we went to a place called the Old Manor Social Club, and the group had named itself, like all role-playing groups give themselves names for some reason, or not all, they used to.
Yes.
And this one called itself South Wiltshire, that's the county we're in, South Wiltshire Adventurers in Time. And just like, sweat. Yes, I said, so sweat. And he said, no, it's SWAT. I said, it's not SWAT, really, is it? And he said, if you come along on Sunday night, you can play in a game of Dungeons & Dragons. And this was the second edition, third edition crossover period, Ruins of Mithril. I realize my story is a lot longer than yours, but but it's a long story.
But also more ominous. Yeah.
And so I
way
turned
more creepy
up,
than ours.
I turned up on the Sunday, looking forward to playing my very first tabletop role-playing game. And it turned out that D&D was running every other week, so every fortnight. And what I had turned up to play was Hercules and Xena, the Legendary Journeys. Which came in a box set. I never bought a copy myself, but the GM and a couple of the players owned it, so it was clearly popular around our part. And, my first ever tabletop role-playing game was Hercules and Xena. And I played a acrobat with not a lot of enthusiasm, thinking, well, so this is role-playing. And I came back the next week, thankfully, and played Dungeons & Dragons the first time. My first character was a 16th level elven rogue, because it was Ruins of Mithranor. It was quite a trial by fire. So,
again, elvish rogues. What is it? Is that the default starting character? Here's your elvish rogue.
No, I was a caster of some sort, because I wanted to be pretty and wear a dress and have spells, because I was 7.
Well, sure, but I mean, do only casters get dresses?
Yes, actually.
In this the pictures, in the pictures, in the books, at the time,
Elminster wears a dress. And you know, and I think Ed Greenwood, if he was here now, he's not passed on, not on time of recording. God,
no, he's not here on the podcast.
If Ed was with us now, if he could speak to us, he would tell us of all the happy times Elminster has run around wearing a dress, because Ed is very, very liberal in that regard, and he loves telling stories to anyone who's prepared to listen about all the times Elminster wore a girdle of sex changes and all kinds of things, and all the relationships Elminster's had with dragons, carnal and otherwise.
So, but we're running on time, but really quickly, my quick Ed Greenwood story. A couple of years ago, I was invited to a conference to speak on panels. This is pretty common, you know. It's like, oh yeah, just put me on with some of the guests, and it'll be fine. And so there was a world building panel, and I was like, okay, sure, no problem. I'll happily sit on it, and we talk about Pugmire and whatnot. And on the panel, it's Robin Laws next to Ed Greenwood, next to me, and I'm just like, what am I doing here? And so he's naturally talking about, you know, all the stuff of the Forgotten Realms and everything going on. And so I'm like, and then my stupid game about dogs, we do this thing over here, you know, and I'm totally feeling imposter syndrome. Right. And then at the end, he was so gracious. He came up to me. He's like going, you know, I haven't heard about your game before, but it sounds like sounds really fun. I'll have to check it out. And I'm just like, oh my God, everyone likes my game. It was amazing.
It's always a cool feeling. You're talking to somebody about the thing that you've worked on, and they're excited about it. And then you realize who they are. That's always my favorite at conventions, is that I'm not good visually anyway. I'm bad at recognizing people. So I obviously don't know what most, you know, role-playing game designers look like. So there have been times at conventions where I'm just like chatting with somebody and it's like, oh yeah, we'll talk later. You need my card, whatever. And then somebody else who knows people better than I do will run up to me and go, do you know who you were just talking to? And I go, no. Are they important? But yeah, those encounters are always
cool. Drunkenly didn't recognize Mike Chaney, our art director, despite the fact I this wasn't the first convention at which I'd even talked to him. Eddie, we won't tell the story because, you know, I actually still feel a little sore about that. The most recent Gen Con at time of recording, one night I drank far, far too much. And it wasn't even a drinking to the point of being ill. It was just a drinking to the point of feeling utterly dreadful. And Eddie and one of our frequent freelancers, Mike Hollywood, was kind enough to stick with me in the bar and make sure I drank lots of water and ate a lot because I bloody needed it. But I know I saw Mike, and he started talking to me, and for whatever reason, I just completely blanked him and just I thought he was someone else, and I was trying correcting him. I was saying, "No, you're this person." And he's never come to me about that. So, you know, I assume we're good, we're cool. But yeah,
you never know with Mike. He might shoot you in the head one day. Yeah. You know it. So, if people wanted to stumble us in conventions and not recognize us, how would they get in touch with us, Dixie?
You can find me on almost all social media at Dixie Cyanide. That's Dixie like my name, Cyanide like the poison.
So you can find me in a few avenues. You can find me on Twitter at clackclickbang, and that user ID has a story behind it that will save for another podcast. You can also find me on YouTube as The Gentleman Gamer. You can also find me on the Onyx Path forums as The Gentleman Gamer. But generally, typing Matthew Dawkins into Google will help as well.
And you can find me on most every social media outlets through Eddie Fate, EddyFate. It's also named my website, eddyfate.com. And of course, you can find all of us usually hanging around at the Onyx Path forums or on our website and blog at theonyxpath.com. So once again, this has been Eddie Webb, Matthew Dawkins, Dixie Cochran. We have the Onyx Pathcast. Many worlds, one path.
Flawless.
Nothing more professional than talking with an outro.
Fatality.
Friendship.